right thing to do. Cooperation with state and local, and FBI in cases like this. Because some clueless, idiot bureaucrat who knows shit about what we do decided we have to work with you people. I get it, but that don't mean I gotta like it, or that it makes sense. You didn't really think the Intimidation Act would work with me, did you? Course not. I try it all the time with the Fibbies. Never works. Can't blame me for trying. He cracked a smile, which looked genuine. Bottom line, Vale said, is that we're gonna catch Roscoe Lee Marks and you guys will claim all the credit for a job well done. Ask any marshal on any task force in the country. He or she will tell you the same thing. That's it, in a nutshell. Perhaps that nutshell is more than a little cracked. I can do this shit in my sleep, Vale. I can't speak for anyone else, but I'd rather you keep your eyes open on this one. The question is not if we'll get him, Hurdle said, ignoring her. It's when. How long's it gonna take us? Don't know, but we will get our man. Assuming you don't fuck up.
Me?
You. I work dozens of these cases a year. In 18 years, that's a lot of violent fugitives. And I gotta say, the FBI always does its best. He paused and looked into Vale's eyes. To grab the limelight. And yeah, screw things up. You guys don't play well in the sandbox. You don't share your leads, but you sure do look good on camera. A number of responses populated Vale's thoughts, and none of them were polite or politically correct. Instead, she said, "Guess I'll have to do my best to prove you wrong." "Don't get my hopes up." "You got any problem with the county police?" Curtis asked. "Not generally. No. You guys are serviceable. Know your place." Vale and Curtis shared a look of disbelief. "Okay," Hurdle said, turning his back on them and walking toward the front of the room. "Let's get started. The rest of the task force will be rolling in within the hour. You know how this works."
"I've got an idea," Vale said.
"There are regional task forces, Pacific Southwest Regional Fugitive Task Force, Southeast Regional Fugitive Task Force, this one, the Capital Area Regional Fugitive Force, and so on. We apprehend the most violent and dangerous fugitives in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Like I said, we work with federal, state, and local law enforcement."
"Even though you prefer not to," she said.
"Even though, yeah." He gestured to a map mounted on the wall. "Districts can have their own local task forces, too, so the Marshal Service in the District of Arizona has warrant squads in Phoenix, Tucson, and Yuma that track fugitives in their area." He turned back to them. "Overall, there are about 60 local fugitive task forces. Most are full-time. Why? Because we've got a lot of bandits out there trying to avoid doing their time."
"You know about the officer's murder, I take it?" Vale asked.
"What officer?"
"The one who was watching Jasmine Mark's house."
Hurdle ground his jaw. "No." He checked his watch. "When did this happen, and what?"
"Curtis and I are headed over there now. Want to tag along?"
Hurdle cursed under his breath, turned to a man behind him and issued some orders, then grabbed his coat and followed Vale out the door. They arrived to find crime scene tape encircling the entire block where Jasmine lived. Police cruisers blocked the entrance to the street, and personnel milled about, mouth vapor offering proof of the chilly temperature. A police helicopter buzzed by overhead. Vale and Curtis pulled up seconds before a car driven by Hurdle. They got out and walked along the asphalt to the vacant police department sedan.
Its door was open, and a crime scene technician was kneeling, dusting for prints.
I don't see no blood, Curtis said.
That's 'cause he wasn't killed here, the man said, in a planter up the block.
Karen?
Vale turned and saw Leslie Johnson, her former partner from when they were rookies with the NYPD.
What the? You looking good. Robbie been treating you well?
Looks like. She advanced on Vale and threw her arms around her, dreadlocks swinging into Vale's face.
What are you doing here? How come you didn't call me? We would have had you over for dinner.
Johnson pulled back. Lots has happened. Shit with the department went down, but I moved here, got a gig with the PD. Yesterday was my first day on the job. Took a big pay cut. Busted down to a detective again, but all...
Wait, Vale said.
She glanced at Curtis, who was observing this with a modestly open mouth.
You're Curtis's new partner?
You two know each other? Curtis asked.
I knew they gave you that detective shield for a reason, Vale said with a shake of her head. Must have been the hug.
Or when I asked why she didn't call me? She turned back to Johnson.
Why didn't you call me?
Johnson shrugged. Things didn't end up good in New York. My mom's out here in Silver Spring, so I put in some applications. Fairfax County had an opening, only been here a few days. Wasn't kidding. Yesterday was my first day.
I want to hear all about New York, Vale said.
Makes two of us, including what went wrong. Curtis lifted his brow. When Vale glowered at him, he added, Hey, that was your idea half an hour ago.
Later, Vale said. We've got a murder that needs our attention. We'll catch up. Dinner or lunch or something.
Curtis gazed skyward at a police helicopter that was circling overhead. So what's the deal here? What happened to Hurdle? Vale rotated her neck, scanning the area for the marshal. She did not see him, so she faced Johnson. Johnson pointed toward the house.
Woman who lives here, Jasmine Marks, woke up this morning and looked out her window at 7:55 a.m. and saw the officer out there in his car.
Where is Jasmine? Vale asked.
Don't know. Not here. I was able to reach her by phone. She refused to disclose her location, but she gave me an accounting of what happened. Got her number if you want it.
We have it.
We're gonna need to meet with her, Johnson said. I told her...
Got it covered, Curtis said. I'm sure it won't be a problem. Go on.
Johnson frowned and shifted her feet.
Yeah. So, she said she went about making her breakfast and getting showered and dressed and happened to glance back outside at around 11:35. New guy was there, so she figured they changed shifts. An hour later, he wasn't in the car. So, she thought he was walking around checking the property. After lunch, about 1 p.m., she looked again, and again, he wasn't in the car.
Ms. Marks started to call Detective Curtis when she heard something outside. She hung up and went to the window, saw her neighbor running down the street. The woman was shrieking. Jasmine went out and discovered the officer's body, said he'd been murdered. She found his body in a well-concealed planter between two shrubs. Jasmine grabbed her purse and tore out of here.
The officer? Johnson pulled out her spiral notepad and thumbed to a couple of pages.
Arrived at 8, relieved the night watch officer, Gregory Greeling, 31 years old, wife and son.
She shook her head.
Anyway, he's got some strange markings on his body. Emmy's still here with the body. You want to see for yourself?
Hell yes. Vale said, and she and Curtis followed Johnson down the street.
Hurdle intercepted them midway and gave them a half-hearted salute.
I'm off.
Off? Curtis said. We're going to look at the body.
Already done. Weird shit. Not sure what it means, but it's not important. Whoever did that's got some problems.
That might be the understatement of the year.
Hurdle backed away. What matters is we got a bad dude out there on the run with a nice head start. On my way back to the command center, Gotta catch us a fugitive, and every goddamn minute is precious. You find the daughter, let me know. I want to make sure she knows to call us if she hears from her father. That's about all I gotta do here. Be back at the motorhome at 5, ready to roll up your sleeves.
He's kind of abrupt, Curtis said as he watched Hurdle move off. He nodded at Vale.
Reminds me of you, Johnson chuckled.
Hey, Vale said, giving Johnson's shoulder a shove. Don't encourage him. Besides, I'm nothing like Hurdle. I mean, he's a deputy. I'm a special agent. He's Marshal's Service. I'm FBI. He's a man. I'm a woman. See what I mean? We're totally different.
Okay. Whatever you say.
Vale continued walking toward the medical examiner. I respect the guy. No nonsense. Knows what he needs to do and does it. Helps to have someone like that in charge.
They stopped a few feet from the body and Vale took in the scene. The ME turned and watched them approach.
First homicide, your second day on the job, Curtis glanced at Johnson. Welcome to Fairfax, partner.
Definitely not my first homicide, Johnson said. I worked in New York, remember?
Karen Vale, FBI, she said to the ME, holding up her badge. This is Eric.
I'm Lindy Dyson. I already know Detective Curtis, and Detective Johnson and I have met. Guess you went to hear about our victim. Time and cause of death?
That'd be a good place to start, Vale said.
TOD looks to be within the last 4 hours, consistent with what Jasmine Marks said relative to when she last saw Officer Greeling. Cause boils down to a laceration of the carotid, massive hemorrhage, clean margins, so your killer used a very sharp knife. She swung a hand around, gesturing off to her left. As you can see from the amount of blood in the planter and the arterial spurt on the surrounding foliage, he was killed right here, and then there's this.
Dyson moved the white canvas down to the officer's waist. Vale swallowed. She had seen it before, but always in photos. The abdomen featured deep, parallel slice marks carved into the skin, down to the muscle layer.
Not deadly and done post-mortem, right?
Dyson nodded slowly.
Correct. And I assume his penis and... Vale cleared her throat. The male genitalia has been excised?
She drew back the sheet farther.
Right again.
Dyson rose from her crouch.
You've seen this before?
Not in the flesh, she winced. Sorry, didn't mean that. Only in photos, but yeah, I'm familiar with the mutilation pattern.
Curtis licked his lips and turned away.
Okay, let's cover that baby up, please.
Johnson was squinting. The back of her right hand covered her mouth.
That's pretty goddamn disgusting, she said, her palm rising and falling as her lips moved.
Welcome to my world, Vale gestured to Dyson to recover the body. We've got a Marshal's task force set up.
Hurdle? Dyson said. Just met him.
Vale gestured at Dyson.
You'll make sure we get all the reports ASAP?
Soon as I can, yeah.
You think of anything, let us know. The guy who did this just escaped from Potter Correctional. Any detail could be crucial. You know the drill.
Unfortunately, I do.
Look, Johnson said as they walked back down the street. I just want you to know it wasn't anything bad. The thing with the NYPD, you don't have to worry about me not having your back. It wasn't anything like that. Nothing bad.
So you said, Curtis continued on for a few steps. No offense, but you lost your job. How can that be anything but bad?
They stopped at Vale's car. Johnson rested her hands on the roof and glanced around. Satisfied no one important was around, she said,
I got a good guy letter.
Vale nodded.
I figured.
Curtis looked from Vale to Johnson.
What's a good guy letter?
A letter from the commissioner saying you've retired from the NYPD in good standing, Vale shrugged. It basically lets you get another job in law enforcement so you can carry a firearm.
So the good guy letter ain't actually a bad thing, but it's not sounding so good either.
Because there's more to it, Johnson said.
There always is.
Remember the Martinez shoot about 10 years ago?
Vale jutted her chin back.
Yeah? Good shoot. You were cleared. No one had a problem with it. So what?
I had another shoot I don't think you knew about. No problems with that one either.
So what am I missing? Curtis asked.
I had one last month that was, Johnson squinted, questionable.
I was off duty. Actually, I was an off-duty lieutenant out for a drink with a friend in Jamaica. On the way back to my car, I see this asshole. Looks like bad news, acting like he's high, carrying what I think is a handgun. He's harassing a couple homeless people. It's late, a few minutes before 1 a.m., and I follow him, call it in. He goes over to some woman trying to sleep in an alley and puts the gun to her head. I yell for him to stop, drop the weapon. He turns to me with the gun. I shoot him before he can shoot me. Only turns out it wasn't a real gun. Some fucking toy pistol. No red tip.
Let me guess, Vale said. No witnesses, no video.
Right. Not to mention I'd been out with friends at a bar and no, I wasn't drunk.
Okay.
And, Johnson said, the guy was black.
So are you.
Probably the only thing that saved my ass.
Again, Curtis said, what was the problem?
Leslie was forced to resign in case it got out about the shooting. I didn't have a great relationship with my chief, Johnson said, so he didn't have my back.
Someone did, Curtis said. If you got that letter from the commish,
Johnson laughed. Trust me, that was done to help the department more than it was to help me. It was done to save face. If the media found out, another unarmed black guy getting shot by a cop?
Too many dicey issues with the shoot, Vale said. Once the media starts digging and finds the first two, they put them under the microscope. Remember, this is New York City. Big stage as it is, stuff can get blown out of proportion, and you know how it is. Some good shoots can look bad.
Depends on how you spin it, Curtis frowned.
No shit.
So we good? Johnson looked at him.
Partner?
Curtis pulled open his door.
We're good.
Vale pointed at Johnson. I still expect a dinner. She gave her a broad smile, then got into the car.
Chapter 12. After stopping by her office, Vale walked into the relatively small mobile command center and found it crammed with several people. Curtis was not present, even though it was straight up 5 p.m. She had guests coming over for dinner, and Robbie was taking care of the meal, so she hoped this did not drag on past 6:30. The oblong room was considerably more crowded than the first time she'd been here, with four more large bodies. There was not a lot of clearance to move about.
Okay, everyone, Hurdle said, a sheaf of papers in his hand. Let's get this thing going.
The door swung open and Curtis walked in. Hurdle made a point of checking his watch and then making eye contact with Curtis. He was a no-nonsense leader. If he told you to be there at 5, he meant it, and he was making sure Curtis knew he meant it.
Let's do some quick introductions.
He nodded at the far end of the room, and a short, stocky Latino man in his 30s began speaking.
Ray Ramos, DHS, Homeland Security Investigations. You can call me Rambo, like everyone else does. Did 3 tours in Iraq, then hooked on with West Virginia State Police for 9 years,
before scoring the gig with HSI. Been on Cardiff for almost 2 years. I got no wife and no kids and no siblings, so I'll be working this thing sun up to sun down, pretty much. In other words, he's got no life. Then again, I could almost be accused of the same thing.
Ben Tarkov, the middle-aged guy with bulldog features said. Marshal Service. Been doing this 15 years. Way I see it, you do the crime, you better be prepared to do the time. These assholes think the rules don't apply to them. I'm here to make sure they do. He turned to the man seated next to him who took the cue and perked up.
Jim Morrison, Secret Service. He was one of two wearing a suit, a black one with a red tie.
Yeah, Jim Morrison liked the Doors lead. I've been known to do some songwriting, but I can't sing too good. Karaoke's about it. I'd say I'm no Jim Morrison. But I can't say that, because I am. That got some chuckles. Anyway, I got my degree in finance from Louisiana State and hooked on with the Bureau. Ended up working the Violent Gang Task Force in Northwest Louisiana, doing financial analysis before hooking on with the service. So, among other things, I can definitely help with tracking down and analyzing Mark's financials.
Suits aren't necessary here, Hurdle said. Cargo pants, jeans, khakis, any of that is fine. Doing what we're going to be doing, most of the time we don't want to stand out and be tagged as law enforcement from a mile away. Be comfortable, casual, professional. Concealed carry shirts are good. When we go operational, we'll gear up with tactical clothing and vests. Got it?
Morrison nodded. Good to have you on board. Whether or not you can carry a tune, your skills and contacts are going to be key. Next.
He nodded at the man to Morrison's left, also wearing dress clothes, a tan sport coat that complemented his dark skin. Travis Walters, FBI. They waited a moment for Walters to add something, but he did not.
How long you on the job, Walters? Hurdle asked.
2 years, first task force posting.
Terrific.
Same goes for you, no suits. Anything you want to tell us about yourself?
Not interested in discussing my personal life. I keep that separate from work.
Hurdle shook his head, then gestured at Vale. Karen Vale, FBI, started with NYPD, made detective, then moved to the Bureau and worked as a field agent before my promotion to the Behavioral Analysis Unit several years ago. I've got a son in college and a fiancé with a DEA, and I curse too much and I get pissed off too easily. And I tend to work too much, trying to fix all that, lead a more normal life.
Good luck with that, Hurdle said. Anything else?
I play well with others, and I'm easy to get along with. Curtis snorted. Vale cut her eyes at him.
Fuck you!
Curtis threw his hands up.
My point exactly.
She managed to subdue her smile. On a serious note, I handled the original Roscoe Lee Marks case 7 years ago when he was put away. Actually, the profiler who drew up the assessment that led to Marks' apprehension was Thomas Underwood. I came in right after that when Underwood retired, so I'm familiar with Jasmine Marks, the daughter, as well as the offender. Hopefully, I'll be able to help with establishing his behavioral patterns and tendencies. We need anything from Jasmine. I've got a good relationship with her. She turned to Curtis.
Eric Curtis, detective, Fairfax County Police, Criminal Investigations Bureau, served on Cardiff a bunch of years ago, so I'm familiar with the drill. Plus, I worked the Marks case. I was the arresting officer, so I know this douchebag pretty damn well. 2 grown kids, a younger brother who's a detective in New Orleans, where I grew up. Oh, and I'm divorced. I'll leave you to draw your own conclusions about that. Because you will anyway, no matter what I say.
Okay, Hurdle said. You've all met me and know who I am. Got a teenage daughter I don't see enough and a wife I don't see enough. and a bunch of friends like you, I end up seeing way too much. Tarkov and Ramos emitted a low groan of disapproval. Hurdle reached over and gave Ramos a swat with a stack of papers. We've got a bit of a new team here, so I'll walk us through some of the things we'll need to get up to speed. Think of me as the quarterback. We'll huddle, I'll call the plays, and you'll go out and run the routes. If I hand the ball off to you, I expect you to run with it. No fumbles. Speaking of which, I run a tight ship. No penalties. By that, I mean we follow the rules and the law when we can. You know some ways to bend shit? Fine. As long as it'll hold up in court. I don't want any asshole going free because of some dipshitly stupid thing one of us did while under my command.
Is dipshitly a word?
It is now, Rambo. Know why?
Because you said it is, boss.
Right. Now, with that out of the way, let's talk about this case.
He glanced down at his papers, then set them aside in favor of an iPad.
Marks was incarcerated at Potter Correctional in West Virginia. He stopped and turned to Curtis. That's a federal prison. Aren't serials usually prosecuted by state or county?
Usually, but Marks copped to two murders and one of them was done in a national park in Fredericksburg.
And thus federal jurisdiction, Hurdle said. Okay, well, our model citizen was involved in an inmate-on-inmate fight in the showers this morning at 0800. Looks like he instigated it against a known enforcer, a guy no one screwed with at Potter. Those two facts should give us reason to suspect that this was part of a preconceived escape plan. The fight was designed to put him in a bad way, so he'd have to be transported to a nearby hospital.
But prison hospitals are usually pretty well equipped, Morrison said. How could he be sure they wouldn't just treat him there?
You familiar with Potter Correctional? Hurdle asked.
Potter's older than dirt, Vale said. Should have been closed decades ago. I'm willing to bet their hospital has never seen the equipment they'd need to treat a serious injury.
Hurdle consulted the iPad again. And he supposedly had a head injury and a wickedly fractured arm. That qualifies as a serious injury.
So, Marks intentionally got his head beat in just so he could escape? Walters asked.
A bit extreme. Hard to say how bad he was hurt. I'm told the nurse only did a cursory exam and said it was an emergency, that he needed to be transported to the hospital.
Nurse could have been in on it, Vale said. Not unheard of. That escape from Clinton Correctional in upstate New York wasn't the first time something like that happened. Woman becomes enamored with a good-looking inmate. He charms her, promises her the world if he can only get out, convinces her he's innocent and was framed, whatever. She hears what she wants, believes what she wants. Sometimes he'll reel her in, do the charm thing. And once he's made her do things that could get her fired or even arrested if they're egregious enough, he's got his hooks in her. He can up the ante under the threat of exposure. She feels like she's got no choice because if he talks, she'll lose her job. So she does increasingly risky things to help him escape.
Have they detained her? Curtis asked.
She's dead. Mark slit her throat.
Another man who makes promises and doesn't keep his word, Vale said. Chuckles and muted laughter trickled through the room.
That's one of the things we'll be looking at, Hurdle said, to see if she was complicit. Back to the escape. He was taken in the back of a small correctional transport truck. Last communication was at 0850. Driver reported nothing unusual. When he failed to check in at the hospital at 0910, Potter went into lockdown. We were notified and an emergency bed book count was done.
Bed book? Vale asked.
Ramos answered. It's a book maintained by the cell house correctional officer that contains a quarters card for each inmate. The quarters cards contain a mugshot photo of each inmate, his cell assignment and job assignment. This helps confirm that the inmate assigned to that cell
is actually the inmate standing in front of you. If one or more inmates not where he's supposed to be, it helps the officer quickly identify who's missing. Like I was saying, Hurdle continued, Potter's off-duty staff was called in, and interior and exterior searches of the prison facility were conducted. All buildings, all closets, rooms, the kitchen, everything. Vehicles were accounted for. Once they confirmed Marks was the only escapee, Potter's staff was assigned to their escape posting in the immediate area inside the city and county limits around the prison. State troopers were dispatched to expand the search, and on Route 48, they found the transport vehicle on the west side of the road, just across the border in Virginia, near Strasburg. It crashed and might have been moved further into a nearby stand of trees. The transport team consisted of two correctional officers, Tarkov said. Correct? Yes, Hurdle said. Driver was shot through the van wall, probably with the other officer's service pistol. Sanders, the guard who was in the back with Marks, was stabbed through the eye with what was likely a scalpel. Nurse's throat was slit, no doubt with that same scalpel. Don't know who was killed first. What the hell was a scalpel doing on that truck? Vale asked. Good question. Possible answer is that the nurse was a collaborator and gave it to him, assuming he'd use it on the guard, not on her. So we've got reason to question just how badly his arm was really injured. Hurdle tapped on his screen. Name was Susan Olafanti. If she was part of the plot, we'll have to reconstruct it. We can't sit her down, obviously. Forensics is going through the van, the prison, the medical facility at Potter. Anything turns up, we'll know, ASAP. Big picture, Ramos said, is that if you escape from a max security prison, you've got to have help on the inside. Day in, day out. It's all routine, scheduled stuff. They've got it down to a science, a proven science, that's designed to prevent escape. It'd be very difficult to get out of a facility without assistance, even an old one like Potter. We'll find out who it was, whether it's the nurse or someone else. Once we're clear on the process of how he escaped, it's just a matter of working backward. How did he have access to that location? Who had access to that location at this time? These three people? Bang. Rambo, you've worked with prisons, Hurdle said, referring to the Bureau of Prisons. Get on this. Let's look at everybody who's had contact with Marks inside the facility. Medical staff, including that nurse, but don't stop there. We don't want to miss anything or anyone. The COs, too, Walter said. See if any have a spotty record. Not just the bad officers, Ramos said. We need to look at all of them, or we could miss something in front of our faces. Even the good ones can get roped in. How can you rope in a good cop? Walter said. Doesn't make any sense. Hurdle's face stiffened. I'll tell you how. I've seen it happen firsthand. He dropped his chin and his gaze bore into Walter's. Let's say you're a legit officer doing your job the right way. You steer clear of all the pitfalls that come with the post. But you talk to your coworkers, right? 'Cause we all do. Stuff happens at home, in your personal life, and you talk about it at work. You get married. You have a baby. So take that example. You come back to work the next day, and you're beaming. Why? Because your wife just had your first baby, Karina, a baby girl. 6 pounds, 8 ounces, and she's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. So you show some pictures you got on your phone and others that you posted to Facebook, and you're ecstatic. You're so fucking happy. Everyone pats you on the back, tells you how gorgeous she is. But you don't know that one of the guys on your block is spilling your dirt. So next day, you're on the block doing your rounds. An inmate says when you walk by, "So, how's Karina doing, dog?" Yeah, You want Karina to stay healthy? How about you get me a pack of Marlboros? Or I'll have some homies come over and take care of your wife and daughter.
Walters swallowed. That shit goes on all the time, Ramos said. No one talks about it, but that's real life. Inmates, as a group, are very manipulative. And they're always probing for weakness, always trying to see what they can get from you. They watch your body language, your face. If they can find that weakness, that button to push, they're going to use it on you. They teach each other how to do this shit because it's proven. It works. Because correctional officers are people working in a very dangerous environment, and not all of them are the sharpest tools in the shed. It's the easiest federal law enforcement career to get into. So, who's it going to attract?
Seriously? Tarkov asked.
Seriously, Ramos said.
Think about it. It's a dangerous fucking job. You know anyone who walks around saying, I want to be a correctional officer when I grow up? I want to walk a beat surrounded by violent criminals and not have a decent weapon on my hip? No, man. If they want to go into federal law enforcement, they're looking at FBI, DEA, ATF, Marshals, DHS, Bureau of Prisons? Not likely on that list. But prisons doesn't require a college degree. So if you can't pass the exam to get into one of the sexy alphabet agencies, you take what you can get. Prisons. And at some point, you try to get a transfer out. You may think that's just my opinion, but I'm just telling it like it is.
Once the inmates identify who the Care Bears are, Hurdle said, it's game on.
Care Bears? Walters asked.
Guards they know they can manipulate, Hurdle said, who'll do what you want and get you what you want because you've got something on them. These inmates know how to twist your arm, manipulate you. Once they know your personal shit, now what do? They own you because you're a human being and you know their threats have weight behind them and you know these bastards are the scum of the earth.
He looked again at Walters. That's how a good officer with a good record and admirable intentions gets dragged into the muck of prison life.
And that goes to what I was saying, Ramos said. It's a big reason why I've never heard of anyone who aspires to be a correctional officer.
Hurdle brought them up to speed on Gregory Greeling, the deputy murdered at Jasmine Mark's house, then nodded at Curtis.
You two find anything out after I left?
Curtis brushed back his hair, which was beginning to show gray streaks.
Based on Jasmine Mark's account of when she last saw him and when a neighbor discovered the body, he was killed in a window that we can narrow down to between 11:35 a.m. and 1 p.m. That fit with what the ME estimated from liver temp.
That timeline also fits with what happened at Potter, Vale said. If Marks escaped from the truck around 9 a.m., he had time to get into Virginia and over to Jasmine's house by the time the officer was killed.
You think Marks did Greeling? Tarkov asked.
Curtis turned to Vale. This was clearly her call.
There were odd markings on Greeling's body, the abdomen specifically. Postmortem slices through the skin, adipose, and fascia to the muscle layer. Parallel lines. And his genitals were excised. A few of the men winced.
I'm not trying to be graphic, she said. It's significant because we've seen this before. Most of Roscoe Lee Mark's victims had the same pattern carved into them. Same with the genitalia. I know you're all intimately familiar with M.O., but it doesn't really apply here relative to the previous Bloodlines murders because it's a different scenario, different situation.
If we assume that Marks is responsible for this deputy's murder, he was not selecting his victim based on the same set of criteria he used for his previous vics. This was an opportunistic kill, one out of necessity. He's presumably after Jasmine. Greeling was in his way and presented the biggest threat, so he took him out.
But the markings, Walter said, the bloodlines. It's a pattern, so more than likely it's the same guy. It's Marks.
In the behavioral analysis unit, we call these patterns ritual behavior. Bottom line is that it's things the offender does with a body or crime scene before or after he kills the victim. These are things that have nothing to do with succeeding in his crime. He measures success as murdering the person and doing it without getting discovered. The things he does to successfully kill his victim and get away with it make up his M.O. These post-mortem bloodline markings have meaning to him. We may not be able to make sense of what they mean or why he's doing them, but all that matters for the moment is that he felt the need to make them. It feeds some inner desire. It's comforting to him in some way. Because of that, the offender does it on all his victims. Or almost all, depending on the situation. He enjoys doing it, and it becomes like a signature that allows us to link his kills.
So, Walters said, spreading his hands apart, what you're saying is that I was right.
Do we know what kind of knife or implement he used to make those lines? Tarkov asked. Kitchen knife that he found at the scene, or...
Great question, Ben, Vale said. No, this was something we're almost certain he brought with him.
At one of the earlier crime scenes, Curtis said, we found a karam bit. Tarkov leaned forward.
A what?
One nasty weapon, Ramos said. A guy in my unit in Iraq, he had one. He picked it up in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, I think. Curved blade, looks like an animal's claw. There are a lot of variations, but the more modern ones have double-sided edges and are used for slashing and fighting.
The original karam bits are small and have a finger ring and extend down from the fist, attached to the pinky. When you punch your enemy, he never sees the blade and you do some serious damage. Like I said, if you know how to use it, it's deadly in seconds with a minimum of effort.
So where the hell did Marks get one of these? Hurdle asked.
You can get them anywhere, Ramos said. There are several manufacturers that put their own spin on the design. Just about any store or website that sells knives has them now.
Morrison leaned back in his chair.
You think Marks left the karam bit behind at that crime scene on purpose?
We didn't think so, Curtis said. It wasn't anywhere near the body. It was in the grass, about 10 yards away, like he dropped it on the way back to his van.
Obviously he replaced it, Ramos said. But why'd he choose such an unusual knife in the first place?
We never found out, Vale said. We can read into something like this, and we did, but bottom line is, it could simply be that a friend told him about it, or he saw it used in a movie, or whatever. And he thought it'd fit his needs. Might not be any meaning to it at all, other than it came across his desk. He tried it, liked the way it felt, and started using it on his Vicks, got excited by it. Or it related to something done to him as a kid.
What he's doing with these cuts, Tarkov said, is it like him leaving his signature on Greeling's body, like claiming it as his kill?
Vale bobbed her head.
Kinda, sorta. But it may not be something he's aware of to that extent. I mean, he was aware he was doing it, but he may not know why he needs to do it. And I doubt he realizes that it's helping us connect these murders to him.
Where's Jasmine Marks in all of this?
Fortunately, she got away, Curtis said.
When the neighbor found Greeling's body and screamed, Vale said, maybe it scared him off. We won't know until we can sit down with Jasmine. I'm going to call her on the way home, see if I can set something up for tomorrow.
Hurdle set his iPad on the work table to his right.
Okay, here's our fugitive playbook. In the service, we call it a quality of life survey. A lot of you are familiar with some of this as your basic criminal history checks. We'll run his sheet, sift through any court documents that list addresses, phone numbers, associations, who posted bail, social media, Facebook, Instagram, phone records, who's he talking to. We'll assemble a top 10 list, look at people who visited him at Potter and everyone he had contact with during the last 3 months before he was arrested. That's at least 7 years old, Vail said. Doesn't matter. Marks is on the run and he needs help. Shelter, food, money, sleep, and it's frigging cold outside. Unless he goes to people he doesn't know, which is possible, it's only logical he's going to lean on those he does know. Or knew. Some of them may owe him a favor. Some of them may be afraid of him and help him out because they fear what'll happen if they don't. Point is, these are the people we focus on. We've got the names of 3 guys he's friends with, according to Jasmine. That's a start. Share those names with us. But from this top 10 list we assemble, we'll branch out and start looking at other people who associate with those people. Where they work, who they've had contact with, where they live, previous contacts and correspondences, interactions they've had. So if they've been arrested with someone in a car, we want to look at them too. Sometimes we find relationships we didn't know existed because these are all people in a loose nexus with the fugitive. Then we look at family members. What about hangouts? Walters asked. That's next, Tarkov said. We'll look at where Marks liked to smoke or drink or watch a ball game, places where he spent his time when he was a free man. Big picture, we'll be focusing on people, money, and residences. What about ex-girlfriends? Vail said. Hurdle pointed at her. Yes, that's a biggie. A guy who's been behind bars for 7 years wants his pussy, and he wants it sooner rather than later because he doesn't know which day is going to be his last. Ex-friends, too, Tarkov said, turning to Vail. Those names Jasmine gave you will be important. Interviews with these guys sometimes nets us useful information. If Marks is an asshole who burned bridges and was generally disliked, he won't have many. That obviously makes our job tougher, but if we've got 3 to start with, that's something. They're not going to want to rat out a friend, Vail said, so it has to be done surreptitiously. I can help design an approach if anyone's got a lead that's promising. Neighbors, too, Hurdle said. Some may have moved since he was arrested, but it's worth a shot. Same with social media. As I mentioned before, normally this can yield us some good intel, but I can't remember what year Facebook caught on. Tarkov looked around. Anyone know? There were no takers. Pretty sure Instagram wasn't around then. What about WhatsApp? We need to see if he had an account with them. Twitter? Doesn't strike me as a Twitter kind of guy, Vail said. For that matter, he's not social to begin with. I'm not sure this is going to get us anything. Hurdle leaned against a closet door to his right. If it's a dead end, it won't be the only one we hit, but we do our job and see what we get. What about where they spend their money? Morrison asked. Yes, Tarkov said, and that's your assignment because that falls under your purview with the Secret Service. Credit card bills, bank accounts, look for patterns. We may get something from those old spending patterns. Maybe not, but we're all creatures of habit. He's a free man again. He may fall back into buying the same things. What he liked before, he'll still like, maybe even crave. Could be the kind of thing he's been thinking about for months, obsessing over every night before he went to bed. The taste of beer, a movie, a football game. Shit he can't do in the joint. Stuff he figured he'd never get to do again in his life. Hurdle stood up straight. We also need to look at what resources he has at his disposal, what cash he's got in what bank accounts. Jasmine may be able to help with some of that. Like maybe she knows what bank he was with. They've obviously been dormant, but she may have kept the accounts active for him. Doubt it, Vail said. Check it out anyway, Tarkov said, in case they're still open and he tries to get at the cash. Never know what we'll find. If we filter things out because of our personal biases, we may miss something important. We're monitoring the phones that the CO, Sanders, and his partner had, as well as the one that Olafanti left the prison with this morning. Hurdle consulted his iPad and typed something into the on-screen keyboard. Curtis, I'm making you point on that. Could give us some valuable leads if Marks took one of their cells when he left that truck. At the moment, I've been told all three numbers have been silent, no activity. Power down or the battery's dead, but anyone makes a call on any of those lines, you'll be notified immediately. I've assembled an Excel sheet with all our phone numbers, Tarkov said, turning toward the computer to his right. He slid the keyboard out from beneath the countertop and started hunting and pecking. Emailing it to each of you right now. Import the numbers and emails into your phone contacts. Morrison gestured at Vale. How about you give us a psychological profile of Marks? It's not really a psychological profile, Vale said, but I can give you Agent Underwood's assessment of the unsub they were looking for, what motivated him, elements of his personality that lent itself to serial murder, and so on. Actually, I'll focus more on what we learned about Roscoe Lee Marks after he was apprehended, because that's more relevant to what we're dealing with here. He's a known quantity, not an unknown subject. I tried interviewing him a number of times over the years, but ironically, it wasn't till a couple of days ago that he finally agreed, probably because he figured it'd be his last chance to talk because he was planning to leave. He was engaging and glib, bright and threatening. Not to state the obvious, but it's not good news that he's out in the general populace.
You think he'll get back into the rhythm of killing again? Morrison asked. Aside from the CO and the nurse, which were part of his escape.
I wouldn't exactly call it a rhythm, but I understand what you mean, and yes, he'll definitely return to his old ways. Count on it. Killing is something these guys enjoy. It fills a need, a hunger that builds over time. He's had 7 years to fantasize about it, not to mention that psychopaths get bored very easily. Being out in the wild, on the run, most people would be nervous. Not him. He's excited. It's one big challenge to him, one he's sure he'll win. So there will be more bodies, very soon, unless we can scoop him up.
Vale rose and rested her right hand on the chair back. We're looking at an offender of greater than average intelligence. Other than his avocation as a serial murderer, he graduated from Indiana University with a degree in public administration. But in his sophomore year, he was arrested for assaulting a dorm mate. Beat him pretty good. Kid didn't press charges, and there were mitigating factors because alcohol was involved, and a witness said the other guy started it. He eventually recovered fully, and no formal charges were brought against Marks. Until his senior year, when he was again arrested, this time for armed robbery of a mini-mart. Problem is, the gun belonged to the store owner. Marks claimed he was with a friend who was robbing the place, and he had no idea what was going down. The owner pulled a .38 special from the register, and his friend punched the guy. The gun flew out of his hand, and Marks picked it up just when the cops showed. There was no video, so they only had statements of admission from Marks and his friend. Marks dropped the dime on his buddy and a plea deal was reached. Case dragged on until after he graduated, so he got his degree. But he served 6 months, and when he got out, he couldn't land a job, let alone something in his major. No company would have anything to do with him, nor would any municipality. He walked around with a ton of student loans and a big chip on his shoulder, got into a few bar fights, and eventually moved back to Virginia. He found a gig driving a bread truck, which put him on the road at 4 a.m., and at home by 3 p.m. That later became significant because it gave him a lot of time to troll for his victims. For those of you who don't remember, he killed a total of 14 people, 11 women and 3 men. Back when Underwood developed his assessment, the BAU was still using the terms organized and disorganized. We've moved away from that terminology, but Underwood felt he was a classic organized offender, meaning he was intelligent. Thought out his crimes beforehand, selected his victims, studied them, watched for lifestyle patterns. Once he spotted a weakness, he chose his spot and snatched them up. He came prepared. No weapons of opportunity. Whatever he needed, he brought with him.
He kept his VIX under lock and key at an undisclosed location. To this day, we've never found it, and tortured them, brought them to the brink of death and revived them before finally murdering them. And then, she sighed. Well, the same thing I described before. The sliced lines on the abdomen and the excising of the genitalia, male or female, the ritual was the same. She stopped and glanced around. They were listening intently, waiting for her to continue.
How did he subdue them? Morrison asked. You said there were three men, not as easy to control as women.
He used an inhaled anesthetic to incapacitate them. Very effective. Vale turned back to the others. The ME was able to determine that the VIX were sodomized with smooth objects, probably plastic or glass, neither of which leave behind any kind of telltale signs or residues. But there was trauma to the tissues, as you would expect, enough to conclude there was some anger behind it.
Do we know why? Tarkov asked.
I'd planned to ask him, but never got the chance.
I thought you met with him, Walter said. From what I know of the BSU, wouldn't that be high up on your list to understand what motivated him?
I'm in the BAU, and yes, the BRIU would be interested in that, as would we. But you can't walk in and sit down across from one of these guys, especially the bright ones, and start asking questions like that without building a rapport, which takes a long time. If you don't establish some kind of relationship, they'll either tell you where to go, or they won't answer the question, or they'll give you a bullshit answer. None of those scenarios are worth a roll of pennies.
Is there anything to that, the sodomy, in your experience?
Yeah, I can guess, but I don't think that'll do us any good. We're not at that point where we've exhausted everything else and have to resort to educated guesses. There are numerous psychological explanations for sticking an object in a victim's anus and doing physical damage. The most obvious, which is why I mentioned it, is anger. You want to move farther out on the limb, you can make inferences. Maybe he's homosexual and isn't comfortable with his sexuality. Maybe he was sexually assaulted as a young adult by a male power figure. Maybe he was sexually assaulted during his stint in the joint when he was in Indiana. You see what I mean? Not going to help us find him.
I think it could help us, Hurdle said, if he's homosexual. Rather than looking at prostitutes or trying to find former girlfriends, we should be looking at gay bars and other hangouts and neighborhoods where gays tend to congregate. I think it makes a huge difference.
Fair point, Vale bit the inside of her bottom lip. I'll see what I can do. I'll dig through the file in case there's something I'm not remembering. I'll talk with Jasmine, see if she remembers seeing anything when she was a kid. She pulled out her Samsung to make a note and gestured at Curtis to continue. Oh, I did notice something I hadn't seen before. When I interviewed him at Potter, he had what looked like a self-inflicted scar on his left forearm. We've learned that self-mutilation is often found in adults who were sexually abused as children. So there's that.
We had definitive evidence tying him to only two of the murders, Curtis said. He pled to those in exchange for avoiding the death penalty. We know he did the others, but they're officially listed as unsolved. We were never able to tie him to them forensically.
And that's not unusual, Vale said, looking up from her phone. Being a smart offender, he's aware of the basic concepts of forensic evidence. Since we don't have a crime scene where he did the actual killing, we're left to examine only the dump sites where he left the bodies, and he knew to cover his tracks, so to speak.
Officially, Tarkov said, those other 12 cases were never closed.
Right, Curtis raised a hand to fend off a comment from Walters.
But the victims' families know the deal. They understand. Some accepted it and have closure. Others need all the I's dotted. I've asked my partner, Leslie Johnson, to get in touch with each of them personally to deliver the news of his escape and to assure them we're working to find him. Unfortunately for them, it's like opening an old wound.
Vale holstered her phone. As I said, Marks has a relatively high police IQ. He understands why we do what we do and how we do it, and I'm sure he's gotten more of an education while at Potter, as well as the Max facility at Florence in Colorado, where he served out his first 3 years. So, bottom line is, we have our work cut out for us. We have a lot of avenues to pursue, but I wouldn't be surprised if we end up with zeros. We may need to think outside the box on this one.
What did I tell you, Vale? She looked at Hurdle.
That we'll find him. It's only a question of when.
Exactly.
What kind of law enforcement support can we expect? Morrison asked.
It's a matter of managing resources. This isn't the same as the Clinton escape in upstate New York. They had intel those knuckleheads were going to skip into Canada, so they brought in the National Guard to secure the border and a gazillion cops to search a well-defined area. Here, we've got all of Virginia to deal with. Because Vale thinks he's going after his daughter, he'll probably stay somewhat close, but he knows that we know that. We've got more officers on the streets, but we can't go hog wild in terms of manpower. We don't want to blow through budgets with overtime and personnel unless it's needed. Bottom line, escalation is based on necessity. Scale personnel to where you think the guy is. Mash your assets in that area. If bodies start dropping, we'll start adding resources. Get more aggressive with deployment, if we can be smart about it. Right now, Tarkov said, we've got a tip line set up. NGOs and GOs are involved, providing lookout, he said, referring to non-governmental and governmental organizations. Media blasts are going to start soon. We've got checkpoints set up at strategic locations along the Virginia border. Next in line would be highway billboards, but we're not there yet. We've got choppers up flying routes around and near the daughter's house, Hurdle said. Since we know Marks was there when he killed Greeling, but that's not going to continue 24/7 with a spotlight and thermal imaging equipment running $1,000 or $2,000 an hour, not to mention that Marks was probably long gone before we even arrived on scene. Hurdle stole a look at the time, which was spelled out in a red LED display above the computer workstations. Vale's eyes ticked over as well, and she cursed under her breath. She was late. Everyone get some dinner and be back here at 10 p.m. sharp. I'll hand out assignments and we'll get started. Vale thinks he's going to kill again. I think she's right. We're a little handcuffed at night, but we can at least get organized so we can hit the ground running once the day starts. Keep your phones on and always nearby. I don't want to hear any excuses about not getting my texts. Everyone got up and started shuffling awkwardly toward the door, slowed by the cramped quarters. Morrison had trouble with the handle, but ultimately got it open, and they filed out into the frigid, damp night air.
"Where are you headed?" Hurdle called after Vale.
"Home. I've got dinner guests, and I'm already late."
"Just be back on time."
"Yes, sir," Vale said as she walked briskly toward her car.
"Heard you the first time."
Chapter 13 Vale phoned Jasmine the moment she got into her car. The seat was cold and the steering wheel was colder. Snow was predicted, but she hoped it would fizzle out.
"You okay?" Vale asked as she pulled out of the police department parking lot.
"I'm fine," Jasmine said. "A little rattled. Check that. A lot rattled. But I'm holding up."
"Where are you?"
"Safe. Which is more than I can say about being in my home,"